Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Stephanie von Friedeberg to the broadcast. Stephanie is the Chief Information Officer and Vice President of Information Technology Solutions at the World Bank Group, a role she's held since 2012. Among other responsibilities, Stephanie is in charge of driving IT strategy and bridging the gap between business and technology. Stephanie began her career at the World Bank in 1992, serving in a variety of roles, including CIO for the International Finance Corporation, manager for IFC General Manufacturing Investments in Russia and the former Soviet republics, and manager for IFC's Global Telecommunications Portfolio, among other roles. Stephanie holds a bachelor's degree from the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. She received her Master of Arts from the Lauder Institute at the University of Pennsylvania and an MBA from the Wharton School of Business, also at the University of Pennsylvania. This interview was held at a CIO Straight Talk event in Washington, D.C. recently, sponsored by HCL. Our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as we discussed the consolidation of the IT department and new skill sets needed in the simplified organization. Principle 3, Project and Portfolio Management, as we discussed how she prioritizes projects at the bank and the use of both waterfall and agile methodologies. Principle 5, External Partnerships, as we discussed how she utilized the venture capital community in her role as CIO. We also discussed new technologies the bank's investing in, including drone and satellite imaging technology, the balance between marketing and IT in a digital organization, how she develops insights from a wide range of employees at the bank, as well as a variety of other topics. This is one in a series of interviews with financial services CIOs conducted in collaboration with CIO Straight Talk magazine. Read an article by Stephanie von Friedeberg along with articles by other technology executives at www.straighttalkonline.com. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be joined by Stephanie von Friedeberg, the CIO and VP of Technology Solutions at the World Bank Group. It's also a pleasure to have Nuria Simo here as a special guest as well. I'd love to understand from you the advantages that you have seen by virtue of having spent so much time in the field so that now you have that deeper connection between the work that IT does and the value that it can create in the field. Can you talk a little bit about that journey?
Sure, Peter. I think it's actually a very interesting question. And I think when I started as a CIO 6 years ago, the CIO role was still very much seen as a technical role. And even in that 6 years, not just my own role, but generally, I think the CIO role in organizations has really evolved. And I think the consumerization of technology is driving that evolution. And people are looking more and more to the CIO to say, how do we use technology strategically in our business to either grow our business or make our business better? Whatever the mission of the organization happens to be. So if the mission of our organization is to alleviate poverty and create shared prosperity, how do we go about that? And when I became the CIO, and if you would have asked any of my technology staff, okay, what's the real mission of the bank? They would have struggled to even tell you what our twin goals were. But then to be able to understand how do you tie those twin goals to the technology that we deliver so that our staff can actually do their jobs better was really something we didn't understand. Mm-hmm. And I think the advantage of coming from operations into a technology role is that you can help the technology teams understand what the business is trying to get accomplished and be that bridge. And I would say today our relationship with the business is so solid that we are quietly leading things that we never would have had the opportunity to do. So we're leading from behind and bringing things to the business that they didn't even know they needed. But now that the teams can actually see and understand what does it take to actually give a task team leader in Ulaanbaatar, the right technologies to be effective at their jobs, they're beginning to say, we could do this differently. So a great example, we have something called an operations portal. And one of the process steps in that operational portal is a review that we do every 6 months on projects that we've already fully dispersed. This thing had 800 fields in it. And task team leaders had to go and, from our SAP instance, pull tons and tons of data. And no one had ever taken a step back and said, why do we have all these fields here? But our teams actually knew the business process. They knew what people were doing with that form. And they knew they didn't need all 800 of those fields. So they took it back to OPCS, which is our kind of policy VPU, and said, how about if we redo this? And how about if we eliminate, 500 of these fields and we change this form so that it actually answers the question you're trying to answer? And it's been a massive success. And we did the same thing very recently with a whole bunch of standard reports, because what we were seeing in portfolio reviews was that people were spending the first hour of a portfolio review trying to agree the data between regions. So why is this region looking at the data on this particular portfolio differently than this region? And they all had very good reasons for that based on the manner in which the business was being done in that region. But if you're sitting above that at the MD level, it's very hard to say, are we doing this consistently? And so we actually, having heard all of that, built a series of standard reports from which the business now makes business decisions. And those kinds of things couldn't have happened, I think, had the technology teams remained the technology teams and the business remained the business. So it was bridging that difference.
That's great. And in some ways, of course, you personify that bridge, having had a foot in both of those worlds.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk a little bit more about some of the innovations, especially digital innovations, you've begun to implement. Before that, though, I want to go back to sort of the beginning of your journey as the World Bank Group CIO. As I mentioned before, the bank had been very decentralized, especially from an IT perspective. In fact, you were a CIO of the IFC, one of the divisions of the organization. And there was a decision made to consolidate. And in order to ensure the organization was able to be as effective as it could be and contribute the value in ways that you've already begun to describe, it meant doing some of the simplification I mentioned, as well as centralization. I don't know if that's a bad word at the World Bank, but at least doing more commonly, let's say. Can you talk a bit about some of that journey, some of the transformation that was necessary in your first few years in order to develop a better platform upon which you could grow?
It's an interesting question, Peter, because I feel like we're just sitting on the doorstep of the beginning of what you can actually accomplish now that we've put all these teams together. When we decided that we were going to merge all of the technology between the five separate subsidiaries, the first thing we decided is, let's not change anything. Let's just bring it together and ensure that we're managing it holistically. And even that was a challenge, because we might have been using the same platform in two different of the subsidiaries, but they were being managed really differently. And so first, even understanding the processes by which we were managing, especially our ICFR and critical systems, took a bit of time. And then how did we standardize those around one common process through which we would manage took us probably two and a half years. So our first instance was bring everybody together. Once we got everybody together and we sort of understood what we wanted to do, then we actually created our strategy. We did a strategic staffing plan and were able to align positions that we needed with new technologies and eliminate other positions where we had redundancies and we had too many people. And then we have now begun to get to a place where we are choosing standard technologies to build new platforms on, and to use those same technologies across all the organizations. So a great example is Pega. We had business process tools that were different in each organization, but we were building operations portals for all of them. And while the business process was slightly different, the purpose of the portals is very similar. So our thinking was, why can't we have a business process tool that's the same business process tool across all of those organizations? So you're starting to see now that traction and that ability to buy a technology and reuse it really start to kick in. Mm. And I think over the course of the next couple of years, you'll see more and more of that, and you'll actually see cost savings as a result.
As you think about building the right team to reflect the value you hope IT will contribute going forward, are there new skill sets you've thought about? Are there new places from which you are drawing talent that perhaps in the past IT departments or even your IT department had not?
Yeah, so, well, we're doing a couple of very interesting things. In our first strategic staffing plan, we made room for 70 or 80 new positions, and those new positions were all around new technologies. So what do we know about the cloud? What kind of security do we need? What do we know about some of the new Microsoft stack, which we were bringing into the house? So there were just pieces that we needed to fill in. And then in addition to that, I think we're a unique organization in that, you know, we're represented by 189 member countries, and we try to make our staff look like our 189 member countries. And if you look at my IT organization, it certainly didn't look like that. It was primarily male, mainly South Asian, and so I said to the team, we need to shift this as well. And so we put together a diversity and inclusion compact, and we agreed that half of the people we hired were going to be female, and 12.5% of them were going to be from sub-Saharan Africa or the Caribbean, et cetera, et cetera. So we set goals for ourselves, and we've actually been hiring in against those goals. And it's taken us a little while longer to fill some of our positions, but we have a way more diverse staff than we had when I started. And, you know, we've only touched the margin. There's 1,200 staff. So, you know, if you hire a couple hundred, you know, you're touching a small percentage. And yet you're starting to see that differential. And the younger, newer staff who we've brought in think differently. They bring fresh ideas to the table. And they are willing to be creative, and they're more curious than some of our older staff. And that, and the combination of really saying we need new technology. So I talked a little bit about how do we choose technologies and use them across the organization. When I came, people were very afraid of new technology. You know, we know this technology, we know it works. Why would we even contemplate moving from it? Really good example of that is our storage stack. So a year and a half ago, the team came and said, you know, we need to re-up on our EMC, and we want a 5-year contract with EMC, and the price tag was huge. And I said to the team, why would we do that? Well, let's go out and look and see what else is out there. Well, you're wasting our time. This RFP is not going to help us. We know this. This is comfortable. We're safe with this as our high-end storage. We did a fabulous RFP, and we have established a relationship with Pure Storage, and we're really changing the way we're thinking about storage, both from a cost perspective, from an access perspective, from a speed perspective. And the team is so excited. I had lunch with them the other day, and we were all sitting around a table. And again, some of them are new, right? They've come in from outside. Some of them are old. They were sort of saying, like, what are we going to innovate on next? What next can we tackle that we haven't looked at for years, that we've just continually read up on the same technology? So I think a combination of new technology and a few new staff and staff who are different from other staff have really started to change. How do we move the place forward?
Mm-hmm. When people talk about the topic of digital, and obviously there's a lot that can be folded under that umbrella, there's a often portrayed a natural tension between, especially in traditional private sector organizations, between marketing departments, for instance, and IT departments as to who takes the lead, what's the balance or imbalance between these types of organizations. And based on my own experience, my own thought is, if one chooses an IT leader from a marketing function, it's basically a declaration that digital is going to primarily be an external-facing idea or set of topics and areas of value. And obviously, there can be profound value in that. Obviously, that's where revenue is derived. However, a marketing leader, should that digital person emerge from marketing, it's not likely that that person has a tremendous amount of internal operations experience, which is also the domain of a tremendous amount of value from a digital perspective. Whereas an IT leader traditionally has an internal view of the organization, an operational view of the organization, but one who has significant touch points to the end consumer, the constituents, et cetera, actually is very well positioned to play this sort of Mr. or Ms. inside outside and really have the kind of fuller picture. And I wanted to test that hypothesis with you because I know, again, you have spent time in the field. You know the business of the bank firsthand, in addition now to developing an increased expertise over the years as an IT leader of the internal operation, the cradle-to-grave processes across the organization that your department supports, leads, drives, innovates around, et cetera. Is this a perspective you share in terms of the advantage for a certain type of CIO?
It is. And it's funny that you mention it because when I think about the bank, we don't actually have a marketing function in the true sense of the word.
Yes.
But we do divide our business between the technology we use to run our business and the technology that we provide in our countries of operation and in the operations that we do. And I come out of providing technology and operations into the internal role. And what I see happening now is I can actually take what I know internally and toss it over the fence to my friends who are in operations, and they're starting to do more interesting things with it. So we just finished a really interesting piece, which is one of our seminal pieces called Digital Dividends. And it really speaks to the internet and whether or not the internet has actually provided the value and benefit that people believed it would provide to emerging markets. And the conclusion is, probably didn't get us quite as far as we thought we were going to get, because there were some critical pieces missing. And having the bank and the IFC in particular put those pieces in place really requires a partnership between the public and the private sector. And the bank has never done that very successfully. So from the role that I sit in now, I am able to bring the key technology players from the private sector to the bank and to operations to say, these are the people that need to connect for you guys to be able to solve some of these problems. And I think in that same vein, an IT person who can do marketing can bridge that same divide, right? How do you think about technology to sell your product? Mm-hmm. And how do you tie those two things together, in my view, in a non-threatening way? And, you know, that's critical. I think the other thing, if you're an internally facing CIO, you need to be able to facilitate and not to attempt to overtake someone else's job. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be the struggle between a chief marketing officer and a chief technology officer, mm-hmm. or, you know, a CIO, is how do you create a good balance of power?
Yeah, that's a really great point. And in some ways, the CIO is ideally suited as somebody who contributes to the plans of every part of an organization, and optimally also outside of the organization, to be that highly networked individual and team to draw insights about where there are commonalities, where there are differences, where there are opportunities, perhaps that even the different constituents don't get the full sense of the weight of, because they don't yet understand how many people are demanding X in common. But IT, hopefully, by having a series of interlocutors from across the organization, can actually draw some of these conclusions more readily as a result.
Well, yeah, and what I see is, so I see some of the big companies. So if you talk about Amazon or Microsoft or Cisco, and, you know, they're big vendors of ours, right? Mm-hmm. And I have very strong relationships with them. And they'll often say, you know, we're really interested in helping the bank. We believe in what you're trying to do. We have no idea how to penetrate the bank. It's a very complex place. Mm. And, you know, how do we find the right way in? How do we find the right people to talk to? In the job that I sit in today, I can be that bridge. I can help them navigate through the bank to the right people, and then we ultimately get more done, right, from a mission perspective. I love that. The more that we can bring the right people to the table to help the mission of the bank, the better.
And I know that you've often thought of kind of building an ecosystem around you. So it's not just your IT department, it's not just the bank itself, but also building. You've already begun to mention some of the, you know, organizations that you have partnered with. And I know, in particular, one of the big constituents that you tap for insight is the venture capital community.
Very much so.
And I'm always surprised when I speak with CIOs who don't realize the extent to which the VC community is hungry for relationships with CIOs, especially VCs who have enterprise technology that they are investing in. Needless to say, oftentimes the customer are CIOs, and the extent to which they can tune their portfolio and tune their investments to things that CIOs want, all the better. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the way in which you have leveraged some of those relationships for insights that you've then brought back in terms of investments or technologies that you've used at the bank.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And again, I came at it from having worked with VCs in emerging markets on transactions and, you know, investing with them in some of these companies. And so for me, it was a natural, well, let's go see what they're doing in Silicon Valley. And I think when I started at the bank, people thought that I was looking for another job. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to Silicon Valley to look for another job. I'm going to Silicon Valley to look for technology that's relevant for us. And so I think the biggest acquisition we made first was Box. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm still on the board of Box.org. I'm on their advisory board now. And since then, we've brought lots of interesting pieces of technology in from having gone out to Silicon Valley and started those conversations. And what I see is now that we've sort of established ourselves and we have that foothold, both the companies and the VCs come our way and say, you know, are you interested in this? Would you like to talk to this company? How do you feel about that? I mean, earlier in the week, I was with the president of Pure Storage, and he said, you know, we have a great relationship with you. You're really technical people. And, you know, we want to show you our development path, and we want to experiment with you guys, and we want to see what else you need and where are you headed next and how can our product develop with you. And I see a willingness on the part of many of the companies that are smaller to work more closely with us to make the product what we need it to be And it's more of a partnership than it is a vendor relationship. And I really value that and appreciate that. I also think that there are some companies in Silicon Valley who are just more interested in the mission of the bank. And their founders and, you know, the young people who work there look at what we do and really understand that what we're trying to do is make the world a better place. And so they're excited to work with us, mm-hmm. which is fun too. And I think from a security perspective, it's important for us. Our cloud-first strategy has made being more close to what's happening in the Valley and understanding, you know, what's the next latest and greatest in the AWS environment or in the Azure environment that we need to understand very important. And so I can't imagine doing it any other way. And actually, if you talk to my staff now, what's really funny is I have lunch with them every so often. And about 6-7 months ago, I was having lunch with a bunch of them. And they said, why don't you take us with you? And I said, well, why not? So we have an auction now. And anytime I travel to the Valley or, you know, to see Microsoft or to do something from a technology perspective, we have an auction and people get to apply. I take one or two people with me. And then they have to come back and they have to talk about what they learned. But it's a way to make that bridge for them to begin to see that change and, you know, how do you think about new technology? It's great.
That's really fantastic. What a nice idea and what a great compliment to those you take with you that you would be investing in them in that way. I also wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the specific ideas that you're beginning to implement. I know from our past conversations, there's some really cool stuff that you're investing in, some technologies that you're exploring, drone technologies, other sorts of things. I wonder if you could share a few anecdotes of some of the cool technology you're beginning to put into the field.
Cool technology. So let's take a step back a second. So when I became the CIO, we did not have any data council or any data governance in any true way. And I kept saying to the president, we need a data council. We need to be able to agree on the terms and how we're defining things so that we can actually give you golden sources of data so that you can make better decisions internally. And what was interesting is I was sort of starting the dialogue from how do we operate the bank better. At the same time, when we started to think about development and how does digital and technology drive our mission, we began to realize that from an operational perspective, we had the same problem. So we have 189 member countries who all gather information differently, who all define things differently. And so when an economist of ours could bring data in from outside, and let's say they were going to compare two countries, they had to do a lot of work to make sure that the numbers were defined the same, and if not, how did you alter them? And then we would make that data available through our open data, but it was hard for even academicians and other people who were using that data understand how did we change it, why did we change it. And so the business was saying, we need a data council that is data for development. So we actually created a data council that has two pillars. One is data for operations and one's data for development. And there's this overlapping kind of concentric middle where you need to define both together. But I think that has really laid the foundation for everybody to begin to think, how do we do more digital? And again, you know, the bank is full of very well-educated economists who are not as tech savvy as one might like them to be. So the conversation about data for development has begun to open the eyes of our staff in the field to say, how could we think differently about data? And then we've hired a couple of millennials who've come in and said, boy, you guys aren't using data really well. So let's think about some interesting things we could be doing with data. So in the data for development pillar, we've decided that every country really needs to do a household survey, and that the household survey should really be done every year, or at least every other year, so that we have some sense on our two twin goals. So alleviating extreme poverty by 2030 and creating shared prosperity sustainably, are we making progress? But there are 75 countries in the world that cannot afford to do household surveys every year, every 2 years. They can afford to do it every 10 years. So we looked at our IDA allocations and said, well, could we give IDA money to some of these countries? But you're talking about $200-400 million of IDA allocations to get household surveys. And is that the right way to do it? So we said, well, maybe there's other ways we could do it. So one of the things we did was begin using geospatial and satellite data. We thought, well, maybe this can actually help us approximate household surveys and household income. And so we've talked a little bit about what we did in Sri Lanka, but what's really interesting to validate Sri Lanka is Pakistan has a very robust household survey process. And so we know more about Pakistan and its income distribution than a lot of other countries. So we took low-resolution satellite imagery in Pakistan and said, what does this tell us about what we already know about income distribution? Not a lot. Okay, let's take high-resolution satellite imagery and have it tell us, what does it tell us about income distribution compared to about what we already know about Pakistan? And they were very tightly coupled. So we were able to then say, okay, if we take that high-resolution satellite, same concept, to Sri Lanka, what can we know about Sri Lanka? What can we know about income distribution? Where can we know the poorest of the poor are? Where can we ensure that what we're doing in Sri Lanka is actually reaching the poorest of the poor? And working together with a company called Orbital Insights, again, one of those Silicon Valley startups, does a lot with hedge funds, but guys that are really interested on our mission, we did a very interesting piece of work that we can replicate year on year if we can't afford to do a household survey. So using geospatial satellite data to solve a problem that we wouldn't have been able to solve unless we would have lent Sri Lanka lots of ITA money that they ultimately would have had to pay us back. So really interesting concept. And then we started to play with drones. So we have a couple of drones, and we've actually been using drones for mapping exercises. So in the Balkans, for example, because so much was lost as a result of the war, and people who knew boundaries or knew where properties were are no longer with us. And there were many spouses, so women and children, who were left without husbands and no way to be able to defend their land rights. We've been using drone technology to actually map land rights and be able to help people go back and say, this is my property. And that's proved very effective in the Balkans. So drones are going to become more important for us. And I think I told you this story, and we're not working with these guys yet, but I think it's fascinating. When I was out in Silicon Valley, one of the requests I usually make to the VCs is, show me a couple of companies that have nothing to do with anything that I would use in my own environment. And so, you know, they showed me an extrusion company that does single extrusion 3D printing. Fascinating. And it just kind of piques your brain. But then they brought in this company that builds satellites, and they've done a project in Rwanda where they've built a drone pod in the middle of the country. It's fully powered. It has backup generation. Then they took all of the medicine and blood in the country and centralized it in that pod. So they know that there's adequate refrigeration, and any doctor in any of the remote community villages can text to the hub and say, I need O positive blood, I need it in an hour. The drone loads it, and within 45 minutes, it can reach any of those clinics and deliver either the immunizations, the blood, the medicine, whatever's needed for that day. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's very powerful. So you talked a little bit about how you see disruption and how you see it changing society. If you think about emerging markets, one of the things that I see is the differential between the haves and the have-nots is going to get even greater. So we have an obligation to help the people in these countries get the best education and the best healthcare they can get as early as possible so that they're actually able to join a digital economy. And so being able to provide healthcare like that matters, really matters. And so I think those kinds of technologies can make a difference in how we deliver on our mission.
Makes sense. I'd love to open it up to other questions. So if you've got some, please prepare those. I'll ask one more, though. You've mentioned a couple times, Stephanie, millennials and the importance of the insights you're drawing from them. And I love the fact that you are tapping them as people who are wired a little bit differently, people whose relationship to technology happened earlier than most people in this room, at least, practically probably as soon as they were conscious, they were using some sort of technology. And I love this whole idea, I'm not quoting you here, but the idea of almost like some reverse mentorship, mm-hmm. of learning from people who are relatively early in their career because they have insights that simply we don't have access to. And coupling that with the fact that there's been a lot of data around how millennials, when they are looking for opportunity, are not just looking for the typical remuneration and the traditional career path, but also doing something with a purpose. And it seems like there are a couple of different ways in which the World Bank's mission actually serves that purpose. So I suppose my question is, I'd love to dive a little bit deeper into sort of how you think about recruiting, how you think about leveraging the insights from younger employees to develop new ideas.
So I think it's a really interesting question, Peter, because, you know, the bank has been built by people like myself, so people who always believed in the mission of the bank. We came in after graduate school, and we stayed, right? And we're an important piece of the furniture in the organization. But the millennials don't look at it that way. I mean, I have a fabulous data scientist, the guy who's actually been working on this drone technology, and he's been with the bank for 18 months. And he came to see me, and he said, I got to get out of here. I'm like, why would you want to leave now? And he said, well, if I stay too long, people aren't going to even realize I'm a data scientist. And I just, you know, I've contributed and now I want to go back. And I'll come back in a couple of years and help you guys again. And because for him, you know, the interest was I could bring in a drone, I could show people how to use it, I could help them build some really interesting models, and then I'm going to go and do something else that leverages what I've already learned. And so personally, I think we as an organization have to be able to bring young talent in, learn from them, and be able to let them go. And that's not something that we've done culturally very well. So we've always been a mentorship type organization. So you come in, you're junior, you carry the briefcase, you write all the reports, and we've got to change our thinking on that because that's not how millennials want to work. And so in my own organization, what we've started to do, and we haven't done it very effectively, but we're going to try to expand it next year, is to reach out to some of the universities that are just in our own surrounding area and say, can we either have internships or can we have people come and work for us for the summer who can help us do interesting things and help us look at technology differently and then send them back out? Because people want to work in the bank. I mean, people are excited about what we do and it's a great opportunity for an internship. So I think that's another way for us to begin infusing what we do. And then finally, I actually think the technologies that we make available are going to help as well. So we have a very traditional model of employment, and we have something called AWS, which is alternative work schedules, which means that if you work 9 days, you get every other Friday off. I mean, ask a millennial, did you want every other Friday off? And they kind of look at you like, what are you talking about? Like, I'd like to be able to work from 11 to 2 in the morning, and then I'll sleep in, and I'll be in the office at 11. So we're actually starting to rethink, what does that flex work look like, and how do you allow people to work really anytime, anywhere, as long as they have a decent work program, and that's all driven by technology. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we'll see that change too.
Well, that's great insights.
Then with the rollout of ICP somewhere, for example. And then together with that, we really said, guys, you are going to see an even distribution. So we rate people 1 to 5 across every single grade in the VPU going forward. And that's helped as well. So we really have started to hold people accountable. And if you are an underperformer, you're put on a performance improvement plan, and you grow.
Quite a cultural change.
Question, yeah, it's huge.
Well, with that, thank you so much, Stephanie von Friedeberg, for joining us today and the great insights that you've shared with all of us. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' 5 principles of World Class IT. The 5 principles are as follows. Principle 1 is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the 3 prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The 5th and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the 4th principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.